From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a new WBUR poll and the challenge facing Massachusetts Democrats running against Charlie Baker. How do you take on the most popular governor in the land? Well, you can say this.
I'm very popular. I have a lot of money. And I'm incredibly tall.
We'll ask, is there an opening for Democrats? It's all part of our week in review. Also today, following the school shooting in Parkland, Florida last month, thousands of students will rally this weekend in cities around the world, including Boston, demanding an end to gun violence.
There's a very bright future ahead when people from our generation keep on asking questions, we keep on speaking, we keep on leading.
Plus, Food Truck Nation, a report on how easy it is to license and operate food trucks across the country, ranks Boston dead last. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and let's begin with politics in a new WBUR poll about the race for governor of Massachusetts. The top line of the poll is not surprising or that new. The survey of 504 registered voters finds that Charlie Baker continues to enjoy high approval ratings and is running well ahead of his three Democratic challengers, Jay Gonzalez, Bob Massey, and Seti Warren. But wait. Dig a little deeper into the numbers and you find something interesting. Yes, Baker continues to be broadly popular, but the poll also finds that when voters are asked to rate his performance on individual issues, well, most of them are not that impressed. They give Baker so-so to poor marks. So the Democrats, who it has to be said, are struggling to be seen and heard at this point, believe that could give them an opening.
How's everyone doing this morning?
Great.
You are the reason why we're beating Charlie Baker this fall. Hull, thank you very much.
And it's been going on for a while. This is former Newton Mayor Seti Warren at last month's Democratic caucus in the town of Hull. Warren is running for governor to tackle what he calls the major issue of our time, economic inequality. And he says Charlie Baker doesn't get it.
And me and Charlie Baker have a very different view on how to address it here in Massachusetts. I believe we need to ask those who are doing well in this economy to contribute more so we invest in ourselves, right? We need to do that. We need to do that.
Warren wants to hike taxes on the state's richest residents to make investments in education and transportation. It's a message that appeals to Debbie Bayer, who came out to the caucus in Hull and who supports Warren.
I like the fact that he wants to make things more equitable in our society. I think that's our number one problem right now.
But despite the energy at the grassroots level among Democrats to challenge Baker, the new WBUR poll suggests the governor remains broadly popular across the state.
He's maintained very high favorables, and that continues in this poll.
Steve Cozzella is president of the Mass Inc. polling group, which conducted the WBUR poll of 504 registered voters. It found 66% view Baker favorably, and only 14% view him unfavorably, and that the governor is way ahead of his three Democratic challengers. He leads Seti Warren by 34 points, Bob Massey by 37 points, and Jay Gonzalez by 39 points.
The governor even has an edge among Democrats, not a big one, but that I think tells you how significant of a lead the governor has at this point in his reelection.
Among those Democrats who support Charlie Baker is G. Michael Gardner from Boston.
I can't say that, wow, what an outstanding guy, what a great job he's done. But by the same token, he's been a good caretaker. He seems to be able to get along with the head honchos in the legislature. I don't think that there has been anything negative that I could point to. So, you know, I think that he's articulate, and that's pretty much it.
Gardner is representative of what the WBUR poll found. Overall support for Baker. But on individual policy questions, voters are less impressed, with only small minorities rating his job as excellent. In several areas, including improving roads, reducing health care costs, addressing the opioid crisis, or the high cost of housing, majorities rate his performance as just fair or poor. In other words, lots of people feel okay about Baker, even if few are genuinely excited about what he's actually done.
I just want to tell you, Charlie Baker doesn't think that we will fight back.
But the Democrats are trying. This is Bob Massey, the environmentalist and author who's running for governor with big ideas of building a green economy. Last month in New Bedford, Massey said Baker may be popular, but he lacks vision, and he accused the governor of duping voters with what he called a Jedi mind trick.
Hey, ready? I'm very popular. I have a lot of money. And I'm incredibly tall.
Well, what's the matter with that?
If we believe that, we're going to lose.
The other Democrat in the race, Jay Gonzalez, budget chief to former Governor Deval Patrick, also attacks Baker for a paucity of big ideas. Gonzalez says he doesn't believe the governor's popularity will hold up under scrutiny.
It's easy to be popular when you don't do anything and you never take a stand and your whole approach to the job is being cautious instead of courageous. And he's got no record of any meaningful accomplishment on any issue that makes a difference to people on a day-to-day basis and no agenda for actually doing so.
But Baker's supporters say his popularity is the result of his record, working well across party lines and sound fiscal management, including not raising taxes. In this year's State of the Commonwealth address, Baker took credit for an economy that has more people working than at any time in state history.
Our economy has added 180,000 new jobs since we took office. And best of all, the number of people looking for work has dropped in every county over the past 3 years, and in most cases, by more than 35%.
The WBUR poll found that the biggest challenge for the three Democrats is that most voters, 62 to 75% of them, don't even know who they are. Pollster Steve Cozzella.
One of the struggles that both Elizabeth Warren and Charlie Baker's challengers face is just there's only so much attention to go around in terms of the news. And Donald Trump and the sort of ongoing national political never-ending news cycle, it occupies a lot of that attention these days. So I think there's some of that going on.
That's what's going on with G. Michael Gardner, the Democrat from Boston who supports Baker and who has yet to even focus on the Democratic candidates.
I've been so intensely involved with the national brouhaha that state issues have kind of taken a back seat.
So it looks like a steep climb for the Democrats. But Michael Dukakis, the former Massachusetts governor who teaches political science at Northeastern University, says anybody can be beaten, even Charlie Baker.
Remember, you're talking to somebody who was 40 points ahead in the polls over Ed King with 5 weeks to go and lost.
Yeah, he lost. That was back in 1978. So Dukakis argues that polls can be deceiving. Today, there are still 7 months to go, a lot more than 5 weeks until Election Day, and things can change. That WBUR poll, we should say, has a margin of error of 4.4%, and we've got the full results at radioboston.org. Stay with us after the break. We'll talk poll, politics, and the rest of the week's news with our Week in Review panelists. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we're going to jump right into our Week in Review, beginning with Charlie Baker's high approval ratings in that WBUR poll. Despite poll respondents seeming pretty underwhelmed by his job performance on particular issues. Joining me now is Joe Battenfeld. He's a political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Joe, great to have you and great to meet you.
Thanks a lot. Nice to see you.
And also with us is Arlene Isaacson. She's a political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, great to see you again.
Hi, nice to be here.
So let's talk about this poll. And I'll start with this question. Joe, I'll start with you. What do you think about, so this poll seemed to point toward a divide between the governor's overall high approval rating, 66% approve of the job he's doing, but these sort of so-so scores around individual issues.
Yeah, what it reflects the lack of passion on the voters to be on Charlie Baker. I think when you have 53%, as you mentioned, rate him poor or bad or fair on improving the MBTA, that's a potential issue to run against on Baker, the MBTA. The high cost of housing, 64%, rate him fair or poor. That's not, those are not good numbers at all. And then you have, you know, improving roads, once again, 62% fair or poor. So I think you've seen an undercurrent of not dissatisfaction, but just people are not generally like ecstatic about the way things are going, especially when it comes to issues like the MBTA. So Baker's going to have to address that and get voters fired up a little bit or he could be vulnerable. I think once the those poor Democrats are running, no one's paying attention. Once the Democrat emerges, I think later this year, it's going to take later this year after their convention and then before their primary, then I think we can accurately judge whether that person has a chance or not.
Hmm. So, Arlene, do you think this poll and suggests a little bit of an opening here for the Democrats?
Well, there's a couple of things going on, in my opinion. Firstly, the fact that they can't, the knowledge of the three Dems is low is partly a function of, I think, three things, some of which you touched on. One are our news media choices. What does the press choose to cover about this, you know, about the campaign when they're busy with so many other issues? Two is the other issues, the fact that Donald Trump dominates so much of the news. People who are inclined to listen to political news could be are often overwhelmed by the volume of news coming out of D.C. And three, it's the traditional incumbent's advantage, whether you're the mayor of Boston or the governor of Massachusetts, you always can get into the news easily, and that always advantages you significantly over your opponents.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I want to ask you about two things. First, Shirley Lung's piece in the Boston Globe today, she wrote that when we elected Baker, we gave up on a bold vision for Massachusetts. Instead, we went for someone who would get the basics right. So, you know, I'm wondering if, Joe, and I'll come to you on this, I mean, this idea that this poll shows people sort of, not great on individual issues, but overall, we're satisfied. I mean, is this sort of where voters want to be? They want someone who sort of basically doesn't dazzle them, but gets the basic issues right.
Yeah, and that's how Baker got elected, basically, by being a competent administrator, not exactly somebody who inspires passion or goes for bold leadership. People weren't looking for that when they elected him, and they're not looking for that necessarily now. I love the quote from the voter that you interviewed who said, "I don't think there's anything negative I could point to about Trump." That would be a great bumper sticker for Baker, huh? Nothing negative you can point to. So I don't think I think the Democrats really, if they had a more compelling figure, say if Amora Healey was running, we'd see a lot different numbers on this poll. Trust me, we don't have a Democrat who really has the heft yet to get the attention or presenting a compelling enough case.
You know, I never really thought of it before this moment, but you're kind of right. You know how Menino was known as the urban mechanic? Baker may be the gubernatorial equivalent of that for some in the eyes of some people, but not a passionate leader.
Yeah.
But he's done a great job in the media. It's been masterful. He always shows his affable, friendly, even-keeled side, which people like. And I think there's another phenomenon that's going on with him that I've seen many times in campaigns over the years. It's the issue of I call it the nice guy syndrome. The nice guy syndrome, when coupled with a good economy, always means that the incumbent gets a lot less scrutiny. People say, oh, he's a nice guy. You know, I like him. So you look in the state legislature, we're dominated by Democrats, but they're not criticizing Baker publicly on any sort of a regular basis or at all. So there's no opposition out there, and people get to focus on the nice guy that Baker can be.
Well, this is the other thing I wanted to ask you both about, and this point that the Democrats in the legislature, for that matter, pretty much any kind of prominent statewide Democrat. We had Congressman Steve Lynch in here a few weeks ago. He could only say nice things about Charlie Baker. He wouldn't go anywhere near endorsing one of these three Democrats running for governor. Robert DeLeo, the House Speaker, same thing. I mean, Joe, what do we make of that? These state Democrats won't get behind their own candidates for governor right now.
I think they like Charlie Baker and they get along well with him. But I think that's undercutting the Democratic candidates for governor, right? It's really cutting them off at the knees. When you have somebody like Boston Mayor Marty Walsh refusing to say whether he would actually vote for the Democratic candidate, that's not good for the candidates out there. They need a little more support than that. But I do think it's pretty much where Baker stands. Like Arlene said, nice guy, affable guy, gets along with the Democrats, and they like that.
I want to ask you one final question about this, and I'm sort of undercutting. I don't mean to sound like I'm undercutting the very work we do here at WBUR, but I'm sort of on record here as not loving how many polls we do because I think we end up focusing too much on the horse race instead of the issues. But anyway, here we are doing a poll. But I was struck by what Michael Dukakis said at the end of that piece a short while ago. That is, things change and things can change in a hurry. And I think we do get in the habit of thinking Charlie Baker's 20 points, 30 points ahead, 30 points ahead, 30 points ahead. And we begin to sort of, I don't know.
Self-fulfilling?
Self-fulfilling narrative, self-fulfilling prophecy, exactly. But I don't know, but either one of you, respond to this idea, how mutable these polls are going forward. How do you look at them, Arlene?
Well, you know, polling work has become more and more challenging as fewer people have landlines. And so there's a lot more guesswork about who you're calling and where they live than ever before. And it's a challenge for pollsters. So I think that phenomenon goes on. And, you know, someone said a moment ago that people aren't looking for a bold vision. I think it's not so much that they're not looking for it, but having not received one, they're okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that these polls are going to be fairly, I'm not saying meaningless, but they're not going to really tell you what the race is going to be like at this point. It's way too early. And until the Democrats settle on a candidate who's going to run against Baker, I think we're not going to have an accurate poll. Once the Democrats get a candidate, then I think we have a whole different story. Saying that, I mean, Baker's at 60% against these Democrats. That's an incredibly high number. He's not just at 50%. It's way higher than even Elizabeth Warren is against her Republican candidates. So they have a long ways to go, these Democratic candidates, if Baker's already getting 60% support.
Well, I want to ask you about Elizabeth Warren, because we also had some polling numbers on her this week. She appears to be in a pretty good situation. If the election were held today, she'd walk away with, as you said, Joe, more than 50% of the vote in any of the matchups. Plus, the poll suggests that most Massachusetts voters have never heard of the Republicans who are running against her. So, like the Democrats against Baker, this is a tough challenge for these Republicans. Arlene, do you see this changing as we get closer to the midterms?
Well, I think partly she's benefiting from the same phenomenon we were just discussing with Baker, where the incumbent has an advantage media-wise and coverage-wise and name recognition-wise. Unlike Baker, she does have a constant onslaught of criticism from Donald Trump and some others, but particularly Trump. So I'm not surprised that her numbers aren't as strong as Baker's are, because when you're under attack, if Baker were under attack, his numbers would go down too, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not surprised that hers are a little bit lower, but she's still in a very strong position.
All right. Well, we should move on, because there's a few other big stories this week that I want to talk about. President Donald Trump was in New Hampshire this week to announce his new plan to combat the opioid epidemic. The president's plan targets three areas. First, prevention, including a PR campaign to discourage people from taking drugs in the first place. Second, expanding evidence-based treatment through government programs. And third, and this is really central to his plan and certainly got a lot of the headlines, was a promise to get very tough on drug crimes.
If we don't get tough on the drug dealers, we're wasting our time. Just remember that. We're wasting our time. And that toughness includes the death penalty.
So President Trump calling for the death penalty on some drug crimes. The president also placed a lot of the blame for the opioid crisis on illegal immigrants and renewed his call for a border wall and condemned cities like Lowell and Boston for not doing more to help federal immigration officials round up illegal immigrants.
In Boston, Massachusetts, which is a place where you have sanctuary cities, I'm repeating my call on Congress to block funds for sanctuary cities and to close the deadly loopholes that allow criminals back into our country and into our country in the first place.
So, Joe, I'll start with you. I know you were there in Manchester,
yes,
as was I. What did you make of the president's speech in a state, obviously, that so desperately needs help?
I thought it had the feel of a political campaign type event, which, let's face it, when you go to New Hampshire, it's a campaign event. He's got to shore up his support there and prevent somebody from his own party or maybe an independent challenging him in New Hampshire. And, of course, you know, in the general election, those four electoral votes are key. So he's going up there using the opioid issue basically to put out his platform and throw some political stuff in there too. Like you said, when you mentioned Lawrence, he targeted Lawrence, Massachusetts. He targeted Boston, Massachusetts. That is a political shot right there at those cities and in Massachusetts in general. And I think there was a political feel to it. The death penalty also, a lot of talk about the death penalty. not, you know, it gets a lot of attention. Not a great way of dealing with overdoses, I would say, but it certainly gets a lot of attention. So I think Trump did not appear to be the most well-informed person I ever heard on this issue. A lot of the things he said didn't really jibe with what reality is. But I do think it was a political event primarily.
I think you mentioned shoring up political support in New Hampshire. I think I was reading a WMUR poll that was done, I don't know, in the last month anyway. He's got an approval rating of something like 38%. So this was in a state that he won the primary, of course. So, yeah, some work for him to do there. But Arlene, the death penalty, on the one hand, addressing a serious opioid addiction crisis, which is afflicting many states. In New Hampshire, more than one person dies every day. Is this, I mean, talk about sort of, I mean, I'm with Joe. I mean, on the one hand, we've got a health emergency and we're talking about the death penalty, and it's sort of right. Hard to find how those two things meet.
Well, you know, like with so many things that Trump says, you want to laugh and you want to cry, and both instincts are reasonable, I think. So he does his tough guy talk, his bluster, which unfortunately takes the headlines away from the real world answers. You know, he loves to talk about, you know, the notion of the death penalty, which parenthetically is probably unconstitutional for drug dealers. But that takes away from the real answers. He talks about undocumented immigrants. Well, the only immigrants he has to really worry about are the ones who own big pharmaceutical companies who have been producing these medications or distributing them in huge numbers and disproportionately inappropriate numbers. So, but he had a few good ideas in there, but they got lost by all the bluster and the nonsense that he spewed.
Well, let's listen to him talk about some of those other ideas, because I agree. It was sort of, I agree with Joe, this was a political event sort of more than anything, but sort of you could weed through the politics and there were some ideas in there. So the president did say that the administration is looking very seriously at bringing litigation against some drug companies. The Justice Department wouldn't comment on that. But we spoke to Peter Shumlin, former three-term Democratic governor of Vermont, on this show earlier this week, who said the government needs to be tougher on the companies that he says are responsible for this epidemic. Here's what he said.
I would, if I were the president, get DOJ to lock all those lawyers in a room and not let them out until they have a tobacco-like settlement that forces the people who got us into this mess to pay for treatment.
And another part of the president's idea was a public relations campaign, a sort of just say no to drugs. So here's Michael Botticelli. He was Obama's head of the Office of National Drug Control Policy, and he's executive director of the Boston Medical Center, Graykin Center for Addiction Medicine. And he says the president should consult prevention and public health experts to create effective ads, as not all drug campaigns have been successful. Here's a bit of what he said.
Just Say No was not a particularly effective campaign. And again, I think, you know, we have to implement kind of what we know to be effective prevention messaging and public health messaging.
But Joe, was there, in your view, some useful public health policy in that speech?
Not really. No, I don't think so. I think he's talking about, you know, cutting randomly. A random throws out a random figure, cutting prescriptions by 1/3. He probably doesn't know it, but prescriptions have actually been going down for years, and the overdoses have been going up. The primary problem now is illicit fentanyl and heroin. The primary problem is not going after drug companies. The drug companies aren't making fentanyl and heroin. The drug dealers are making that stuff, and that's the stuff that's killing people. That's what they have to address now. So, I think getting tough on drug dealers definitely is something that they should be doing. So that was one constructive idea, I think, getting tougher on drug dealers, because that's why people are dying. But he's not addressing also the economic factors. You know, addiction is a serious issue. A lot of it has to do with economics. People who are poor, who have lost their jobs, are more prone to addiction and more prone to this crisis. And that's fed a lot of this crisis as well. So it's a lot of serious issues. I don't think his proposals really caught them.
Let's come back to this idea of the death penalty, because Governor Charlie Baker has endorsed legislation that would have required an opportunity for district attorneys to charge major drug traffickers with murder in Massachusetts. But as far as Trump's proposal goes, Baker told reporters this week, he'll have to take a closer look at it. Here's what he said.
With respect to the death penalty, I think I'd rather see the details on this. I don't know what the limits or the elements of this particular proposal were. We were very careful in our proposal to choose traffickers because there are many people who are just small-time dealers who in many cases are supporting their own unfortunate habit.
I mean, you know, it's interesting. I listened to the White House briefing before the president's arrival in New Hampshire, Arlene, and in terms of how this death penalty would even be carried out, they couldn't explain. They said, we refer you to the Justice Department, but it would basically be applied under applicable law, which sounded vague and strange
and
to me.
Ridiculous. And it'll be interesting to see if Trump supports the death penalty for the execs from big pharma companies and the distribution companies that generate all these pills. But I somehow think that isn't going to happen. You know, law enforcement's been very clear that we can't enforce our way out of the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. that the real solution, you know, to do the tough talk and scream about mandatory minimums. Well, we've been doing mandatory minimums for 30 years, and it's been viewed as a failed drug policy. Treatment is one of the key ways to get out of this mess. It's going to require a lot of money. But it really has been the one successful way of dealing.
All right. Well, I want to move on and talk about the Massachusetts State Police. This story, because they've been embroiled in another controversy. 19 troopers are facing hearings. They could be suspended without pay after an internal audit found discrepancies between overtime pay and actual shifts worked by these troopers. Now, the controversy comes months after the Boston Globe found that 245 state troopers, about 12% of the force, made more than $200,000 last year, mostly in overtime pay. State Police Colonel Kerry Gilpin, appointed last November, says these discrepancies are disheartening.
I came on this job for a reason, to make a difference, for public respect, for public trust, and to think that these alleged actions occurred, not just prior to me, but now under my watch. And that's why we've expanded it to go Commonwealth-wide, and we're looking at all the overtime patrols to make sure that this does not happen again.
And Governor Charlie Baker, he defended the state police as a first-class enterprise, but suggested that there were a few bad actors.
People should face the music with respect to what they've done, if the investigations determine that, in fact, what's been alleged is for real.
So, Arlene, what does this say about the state of the state police? What do you make of this story?
Well, you know, it's the new head of the state police, Gilpin, talks about the importance of fulfilling the mission of a police agency, that they have to have the public's trust. And she's right on point about that. Unfortunately, you know, anyone who does this is breaking the law. Anyone who does this is doing something wrong, and they know they're doing something wrong. And unfortunately, it does a disservice to the many good state troopers who play by the rules. You know, I'm not upset, as some people might be, about troopers who, you know, make $200,000 through overtime, as long as they're doing it all on the up and up, and very importantly, as long as they are not overtired when they do their shifts so that they don't use bad judgment. I mean, heck, when I took my daughter to the emergency room a few years ago, I didn't want a doctor dealing with her and touching her who had been up for 24 hours because I figured his judgment couldn't be good as a physician. I wouldn't want someone holding a gun to be tired either.
Mm. Joe, what's your take
on this? We're talking over 20 state troopers were allegedly doing this, fudging their numbers. Basically, what I understand they were doing is putting down dates they worked that they didn't work. They were changing dates on tickets to make it seem like they were working those days. That's illegal. You know, and this is a serious problem, and this is something that Governor Baker, I believe, is soft-pedaling, actually. He doesn't want to get hung with it because he knows there could be political damage that comes with it. But it's a serious issue, and it's not the only scandal that the state police have faced. There's been about two or three other scandals that we've heard about that the state police have been involved in recently. So they have a serious problem over there, and this is under Governor Baker's watch. And he should get tough on people who are doing this.
Well, we started this segment talking about our poll, and we actually have a poll number on this issue about, a majority of the respondents said Baker was doing a good or fair job at managing the state police. I'm not sure how closely engaged our sample of respondents were to this issue, but do you think this scandal will affect him? I mean, does this become an issue that Charlie Baker has to contend with as he moves toward an election?
I think it could have been but to the extent that you've got the head of the new head of the state police talking about the importance for honesty and integrity, and you've got the governor saying they're going to have to what's the phrase? Pay for the listen.
It was old face the music.
Face
that's
the
about
music.
As close as Charlie Baker gets with his language. They're going to have to face the music.
It's a quintessential Baker phrase.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Face the music. So I think that he'll be able to say that and have people move on.
All right. Well, we better move on because we're running out of time, and I want to leave time for our hubbubs, those brief stories or events that caught our attention this week but didn't really get above the fold. Arlene, what's your hubbub?
Well, since there's a week and a half left, only a week and a half left to Women's History Month, I wanted to flag something for those people who like history. The Freedom Trail is offering for this month only a tour which they call Revolutionary Women Tours, in which they describe women who took part in the American Revolution and the generations of women that followed, that fought for freedom and equality. So it's a 90-minute walking tour led by costumed tour guides, and it's for all ages. And they go through women that range from women who've changed history, from Anne Hutchinson and Mary Dyer to Abigail Adams, Harriet Tubman, authors like Phyllis Wheatley and Louisa May Alcott, and speeches from Margaret Sanger and Susan B. Anthony. But there's only 3 days left because they do it only on Sunday and Saturday. And if you're interested, you should just stroll down to the Boston Common Visitor Information Center, because apparently you can't buy tickets online, at 12:45. And it sounds fabulous.
All right. The Revolutionary Women's Tour. Great idea. Joe, how about your hubbub?
Well, for everyone who's sick of winter, sick of the cold weather, a good sign, the piping plovers are back, are starting to come back to Massachusetts beaches, I just heard. And that means, of course, they have to cordon off all the big areas for them to nest in. But it's definitely a one sign of spring. They don't care whether it's cold out, whether, you know, it's still snow on the ground. They come back every spring. And they're actually proliferating pretty well on the beaches here in Massachusetts. And I think so that's one hopeful sign.
All right. Sign of spring. Well, my hubbub is also about a sign of spring. It's about that big nor'easter that wasn't. And what's funny about this is that a lot of people seem to be disappointed. I mean, they were disappointed when these storms come, and then the storm doesn't come.
Not
it's
me.
Like, what's this?
You know, I was disappointed.
We love to complain when it's hot, when it's cold. We complain when it snows, and we complain when it doesn't. But my hubbub is about, it's a shout out actually to this very cool weather app that I have, which is Dark Sky. And the only reason why I want to give it props is because I was up at my son's school Tuesday, the day before the big storm, and everyone was saying, are we going to get 9 inches, 11 inches, or 12 inches? And I looked at Dark Sky, and it said 0 to 1 inches tomorrow.
Really? Ooh.
Yeah, so they got it right.
Check it out.
So score one for Dark Sky. And let's be happy that it didn't snow. And as you suggested, Joe, spring is really here. Opening day is less than a week away. Now, there's a sign of spring, so that's exciting. Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks, Joe, for coming in. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for having me. You too.
And Arlene Isaacson, she's a political consultant, co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Arlene, always great to see you.
Nice to see you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow, students demanding gun safety and an end to gun violence will march in Boston, one of 800 marches happening around the world. The student movement, March for Our Lives, sprang to life following the school shooting last month in Parkland, Florida. The Boston March is expected to be among the biggest, attracting thousands of students, parents, teachers, and advocates. And WBUR's Edify reporter Carrie Young is covering the march here in Boston. She joins us now. Hi, Carrie. Thanks for coming in.
Hi.
So tell us what we can expect from the march tomorrow.
Well, it's a full-day event. Now, officially, things really kick off around 9 a.m., and that's when marchers are expected to gather at Madison Park High School campus. Then around 11 o'clock, the group will be setting out on what's almost a three-mile walk down Columbus Avenue to Boston Common, where they'll be holding a rally at 2 o'clock. Now, I've been told there are a number of events on the docket, from poetry readings, music and dance, and then also some speeches, though exactly who will be speaking is still being kept private. But we do know there will be local students and teachers.
All right. Do we know anything more about sort of who's going to be participating?
Well, the city says they're expecting about 20 to 25,000 people, although according to the Facebook event page, there are about 55,000 people who have expressed interest in coming. Obviously, this is going to be a large showing of students, which means people under 18, but teachers will be there in large numbers. There's a group of Marjory Stoneman Douglas alumni who will be there, and one interesting addition I just heard about today was healthcare workers. I spoke with Dr. Charles Morris today, who is the chief medical officer at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. He says about 100 people from their facility will be meeting to make signs tomorrow and then marching with the students. And Morris tells me his group is marching to stand in solidarity, but he says they'll be there because firearm violence, no matter where it happens, is an issue of public health.
It's not an issue of Second Amendment or gun rights. This is a genuine threat to the health of the patients for whom we have the privilege to care. And because it's a public health issue, and health is our business, health matters to us, we're all invested in this issue from that perspective. Hmm.
Now, I also reached out to the Boston Police Department to see if anything special will be organized or planned for the event, and they told me that this will be, they'll be handling this like any other large event on the Common.
Now, I understand there's going to be a counter-protest as well. What do we know about that?
Yeah, well, the group known as Resist Marxism is also organizing a gathering at the Common. Now, you may remember that name because they are the same group that organized last year's free speech rallies. By the looks of it, at least according to their Facebook event page, about 100 people say they'll be going to that. And in a statement on their page, they say they'll be there to defend their right to keep and bear arms, adding that they will not, quote, submit to bans on so-called assault rifles or governments using arbitrary lists to infringe upon the Second Amendment.
All right, Carrie. Well, stand by because I want to introduce Vikiana Pettit-Holm. She's a junior at the Boston Latin Academy and one of the co-organizers of tomorrow's march in Boston. And Vikiana, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell me why you decided to co-organize this event. Tell me something about it.
Well, gun violence is an important issue that affects a lot of people in America. Actually, on average, 96 people die from guns every day in America, which is extremely high. And the fact that the youth are given this platform right now is extremely powerful because we're not able to vote yet. We're given this platform to share our opinions and influence the people who can actually vote right now. So I thought it was my personal duty to be part of this movement and to speak for the ones who aren't alive today and to speak for my classmates who have to face gun violence on the way home from school or who don't feel safe to go to school. So,
Vikiana, tell me what you and the other organizers hope to achieve through this event. What would you like to see come out of these marches that are happening all over the world, by the way, as we mentioned?
So here in Massachusetts, we do have the strictest gun laws, and in turn, we have the lowest amount of gun deaths. But there's still more that can be done. So, for example, we don't have an ERPO bill right now, which is something that we're advocating for.
That's an extreme risk protection order bill, right? And this would essentially allow family members to go to a authorities and say, I'm worried about my son or my brother who's acting weird, who's depressed and has a gun and is talking about killing himself, and they could actually take the gun away from him.
Yeah, that's it. So that's House Bill 3610. We're also advocating for Senate Bill 2326, I believe, and that's an education equitability bill. So it's about funding for schools because gun violence and education, they're really connected. And if we increase more funding into our education system, then we believe that gun deaths will decrease also. So those are the two things we're kind of hoping right now and the things that we're pushing through this march. And we just want to pressure our lawmakers into taking more action against gun violence because although we do have the lowest gun deaths in the nation, we shouldn't be comparing ourselves to America because guns are deeply embedded in American culture, so they're not the best person to compare ourselves to. We need to compare ourselves with the rest of the world.
Carrie, Vikiana, stand by. I want to come back to Carrie for one more question. This movement was catalyzed by the survivors of the Parkland shooting in Florida. You got to speak with them earlier this week when they came to Harvard. Tell me what you heard from them.
I did, yeah. Well, I mean, the one thing that really sticks out to me, especially towards the end of their time at Harvard, was they had this sense of hope. 17-year-old Cameron Caskey said that it's really encouraging to see so many people come together in this country, adding that this march is a clear sign that people are actually unifying rather than being divided.
There's a very bright future ahead when people from our generation keep on asking questions, we keep on speaking, we keep on leading, and we expect Western politics and the whole conversation involved to be a much better place than the one we were given.
Vikyan, I want to come back to you for just one more question. Of course, this movement sprang up after the shootings in Parkland. Sadly, school shootings, mass shootings have become almost routine in this country. Often after these tragedies, people demand action on gun safety. Nothing happens. This feels different. This moment is still alive. I mean, this movement is still alive. What explains that? How do you explain that?
I think it's mostly due to the fact that there's more youth involvement this time. Youth are actually stepping up and being the leaders of the change, and we're not going to just let this go after the march. We're going to keep fighting. And so one thing we've seen is Somerville High School, they've done Walkout Wednesdays, and that will continue to happen until change is made, even after the march. You know, we're continuously fighting for change, and youth have more of a say, and we're a generation that have grown up with gun violence, and it's something that we've seen since we were little and something that we've been trying to protect ourselves from since we were little. So I think we're invested more into this.
Well, Vikyana Petit-Holm is a junior at the Boston Latin Academy and one of the co-organizers of the march in Boston tomorrow. Vikyana, thanks for joining us and good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Carrie Young, Edify reporter for WBUR. She'll be covering the event tomorrow. Carrie, thanks for
You're
coming
welcome.
In. Appreciate it. Let's turn now to a new report from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce Foundation that looks at regulations for food trucks in 20 cities across the country, from Los Angeles to Boston. The report, Food Truck Nation, ranks cities on a variety of factors, including the ease of obtaining a licensing permit, complying with the laws, and operating a food truck. Portland, Oregon, ranked number one, coming in at number 20, dead last, Boston. For more on the report, we're joined by Matt Geller. He's a consultant who helped with the report, and he joins us on the line from Los Angeles, California. Matt Geller, good to have you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you taking the time to listen to us about food trucks.
Yeah. Can you tell us why Boston did so poorly on this report from the Chamber of Commerce?
Well, I think, nationally, when I look at different regulations, there are different philosophies about how government should regulate food trucks. In Los Angeles, in Portland, the city government has the philosophy that their responsibility is to public health and public safety. So where they park, as long as it doesn't get in the way of sight lines, not too close to schools, and then from a public health perspective, that the temperatures of food are going to be right, food safety is going to be right. And then above and beyond that, they're looking more at the market to decide the winners and losers. On the East Coast, we see a lot more protectionism for restaurants, as if maybe the city government is responsible to protect the financial interests of established brick-and-mortar restaurants. So that's the big thing. And since Boston has, large permit fees, a lottery system, they just end up being dead last because the city government is just not doing just public safety and public health. They're really just...
So, Matt, I'm just looking at some of these numbers, and some of them are quite stunning. So annual regulatory operating costs for food trucks in Boston can be as high as $37,000, $37,900. Compare that to Portland, Oregon, where food truck owners faced about $5,400 in annual fees. So that's quite a difference. So let me introduce a couple of local food truck owners. And Rebecca Simonson, Vice President of Community Engagement for Bon Me, based out of Roxbury. Rebecca, great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And also in the studio is James DeSabatino. He's the owner of Roxy's Grilled Cheese. And great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So let me start with you, James. When you hear this report, this Food Truck Nation report, how does it strike you? Are you surprised to hear that Boston ranks 20th?
You know, I think it kind of reaffirmed what I've always felt since the program started in 2011. It always felt like it was challenging for kind of new trucks to enter it and for existing trucks to kind of sustain what they're doing in the city. And this report really kind of brings to a head like the frustrations and challenges that the food truck industry faces.
Right. So what's number one on your list of frustrations?
Challenges. Yeah, I mean, I think all around the regulations make it really tough for someone who's looking to get into this industry to be able to make a career out of it. Like even now, the city is actually moving people away from considering vending on the streets as a way to make most of their revenue, and they're actually pushing people in towards thinking about catering and private events and events outside of the city. So they're treating the Boston program now as more of a supplement to your whole food truck business rather than the actual food truck business.
All right, Rebecca, let me turn to you. And if I have it correctly, as Vice President of Community Engagement at Bond, you used to be the director of mobile operations, right?
I was, yes.
Which meant running around to get all the Bond Me trucks permitted. What
was
your
a lot
experience?
Of running around.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I think Boston has a thriving and amazing food truck scene.
There are a lot of them out there, it seems like.
Exactly. Since 2011, the program has grown from 11 to something like 95 trucks. So I think that that's really incredible. And my experience has been that the city of Boston has made a lot of improvements to the permitting and regulatory processes over the past years. And they've really been trying to work with the food truck operators to make this process as easy as possible.
So the city is to that issue. The city of Boston released a statement from John Barrows, chief of the Office of Economic Development, which says supporting small businesses and entrepreneurs is a priority and that the city is working with the Food Truck Advisory Committee to expand opportunities and strategically grow Boston's food truck program. James, do you if John Barrows were sitting in here, what would you like to say to him to sort of make job a little bit easier?
I think he is onto something. I think that there were some missteps over the years with getting a new mayor, bringing kind of a new regime to oversee how food trucks really operate in the city, and they really are making an earnest effort to communicate better directly with the trucks to make sure that these trucks have someone in local government that they can call when there's a problem. So I do think there are a lot of improvements being made. There is going to be a long way to go in order to allow kind of this industry to be sustainable for someone who wants to enter it.
Matt Geller out in Los Angeles, I'm wondering if you could talk about a big difference, it seems to me, between East Coast and West Coast. You mentioned some of them, but, when I'm thinking about the layout of Boston and the way these food trucks operate, you go a mile and a half and you can cross over two or three different you go from Boston to Somerville to Cambridge within a sort of 3 mile ride, whereas Los Angeles, you're just in Los Angeles forever. I mean, doesn't that make the regulatory process a little simpler?
No, actually, Los Angeles County is a question of 88 cities. I can be in Santa Monica, Los Angeles, West Hollywood, Culver City in a 30-minute drive. So the food trucks deal with very similar situations.
Interesting.
The difference is in all of the locations I mentioned, except for West Hollywood, food trucks can park wherever a car can park and stay for as long as the meter says they can stay for. So once they get that business license, they're not hemmed in by where the city says they can do business. They can do business essentially wherever. I mean, the restrictions are, you have to abide by the painted curb and the posted sign, and you can't be within 500 feet of a school. Other than that, they can operate the way they want to operate. They don't have to pay to be a particular location.
I get it.
In the city of Los Angeles, they can do business on any commercially zoned piece of property by right. And then in some of the smaller cities, they have to have some sort of permit, but they're pretty easy to obtain.
Well, Rebecca, let me ask you about that. Does this issue that I suggest, you were sort of nodding your head when I was describing all of these cities and towns being so close together in this one municipal area around Boston, is that a challenge?
It's a big challenge. it's definitely the biggest permitting challenge that we have is once you cross over from the city of Boston to any other municipality, you have a redundancy in applications, permits, inspections, fees. It's really dizzying to keep track of, not to mention the additional costs that go along with that.
So what's the solution? How do we simplify that in about the 10 seconds that remains in our program?
Yeah, I know Michelle Wu with the city of Boston is looking to talk to people in the different cities and towns. And so if we could get a common application and set of inspections, then that would be a big help to the food truck community.
All right, Matt Geller, final word to you. What would you like to see happen? I'm not sorry, Matt. Excuse me, Matt. I want to give it to James DiSabatino because he's sitting right here.
Yeah, I think, you know, communities become more fun when there's events where you can bring food from all over the place. The ability for trucks to get together and hang out at an event needs to be streamlined, and then that's the next step.
All right. James DiSabatino, owner of Roxy's Grilled Cheese, and Rebecca Simonson, Vice President of Community Engagement for Bon Me, based out of Roxbury. Thank you both for coming in. Appreciate
it.
And Matt Geller, consultant who contributed to the Food Truck Nation report. You can find a copy of that at RadioBoston.org. Matt Geller, thank you. Have a great weekend.
Thanks. Bye.
And that's it for this week. I'm Anthony Brooks. Have a great weekend and join us again Monday for more Radio Boston.